250 years ago, 94% of everyone alive on the planet Earth lived on less than $2 a day. Illiteracy rates across the world were 88%, and the average lifespan was 30. It has been capitalism, it has been economic freedom combined with scientific breakthroughs that have allowed humanity to begin to lift out of the dirt. People just don't understand that. They look around and they see that we're not living in utopia, and that's why I think every generation has the siren call of socialism.
At Freedom Fest in South Dakota, I sat down with Whole Foods CEO John Mackey to discuss the deceiving allure of socialism and his philosophy of conscious capitalism.
Socialism's been tried 41 times in the last 100 years, and there are exactly 41 failures.
This is American Thought Leaders, and I'm Yanya Kelik. John Mackey, such a pleasure to have you on American Thought Leaders.
Thanks for having me on today, Yan.
So, John, you, of course, I think are very well known for being the CEO of Whole Foods. And at the same time, you're also the author of a book called Conscious Capitalism. Let's start with, you know, conscious capitalism and frankly, even the premise, because I think not a lot of people really get what that means.
Well, conscious capitalism is, first, it's very pro-capitalism. So people misunderstand that. Conscious capitalism is simply based on four basic pillars. The first pillar is that every business has the potential for a higher purpose besides only making money. And that higher purpose will have something to do with the value creation a business does for its customers, and its purpose will lie in that. So Whole Foods' purpose is to help nourish people and the planet. Google's higher purpose is to organize the world's information and make it readily accessible. So these are ways we create value for our customers. And I oftentimes think capitalism's misunderstood as simply being about maximizing profits. And making money is a good thing, but it's the result of fulfilling its purpose of creating value for other people, other stakeholders and particularly customers. Second, that there are stakeholders in an organization they all are important, they all matter. The primary stakeholders of any business is first its customers, second its employees, third are its investors, fourth are its suppliers, and fifth are the communities that it's embedded in. And so when you're doing conscious capitalism, you're aware that these stakeholders are interdependent. And so if let's say that Whole Foods is, we're a grocery store, so our job, the management, is to hire the very best people we can find, make sure they're well trained, and then that those team members are flourishing and that they're happy in their work. Because the team member's job is to make the customers happy. But if they themselves are not happy and flourishing, they will not give as good a service. So happy team members results in happy customers, which results in happy shareholders. And so there's an interdependence. And once you recognize that interdependence, you begin to manage the business differently. You manage it in such a way that you're seeking win-win-win solutions and strategies that are good for all the stakeholders. So you're just doing the business more consciously regarding stakeholders. The third pillar is that we have to create leadership that's not simply trying to line their own pockets, maximizing their personal gain, but that they are serving the purpose of the higher purpose of the organization and that they're serving the stakeholders. So we put an emphasis on sort of servant leadership. A conscious leader is one who serves purpose and stakeholders. And fourth, we want to create a cultures where people, human beings, have to work and where they're flourishing and that they're, and the culture allows people to learn and grow and reach their highest potential. So purpose, stakeholders, leadership, and culture, all done in a more conscious way. And that's the essence of conscious capitalism.
So it seems like when a corporation or a company is sort of embedded in a local community, there's a kind of a natural accountability that happens, right, to the community, right? And I think it's been argued, and this is something I've actually frankly noticed in my life in various junctures, that when that relationship is broken somehow because the corporation becomes multinational or it operates, it begins operating without that kind of level of accountability. And it seems like, you know, especially maybe some of the biggest corporations are sort of in danger of this kind of situation. So how do you get conscious capitalism in a situation where there that connection becomes somewhat severed?
Well, I can talk somewhat well-informed about my own business. I mean, Whole Foods has 530 stores, and we're in hundreds of different communities, mostly in the United States, but also Canada and the UK. So we know that we're embedded in local communities, and all multinationals are also embedded in communities. We have an impact on the communities that we're part of. We don't live in some cyber world. We don't live apart from everyone else. We not only have local communities, but we have a supplier chain, a supplier network that's all around the world. So we purchase from thousands of different suppliers and growers, and mostly in the United States, but also all around the world, because we want to sell the highest quality natural and organic foods wherever we can find them. And so we feel a special responsibility to be a good citizens in the communities that we're in. And our philanthropy, and creating jobs for people wherever we go, making sure that we are seen as good citizens in each community that we're in. I think business has a responsibility to be good members of the communities that they're part of, and that they don't stand a part of it. That's a huge mistake in thinking that somehow their business lives in some other universe. It doesn't. It lives in the human universe, in communities where they have neighbors and friends, and therefore they have certain civic responsibilities, just like every other citizen does.
We're also in this situation now where we have corporations, large and small, being somehow, you know, pressured by various special interest groups to kind of engage in politics, so to speak. And we see businesses actually doing that in a whole, you know, for a whole variety of examples. Again, I don't need to go into any particular specifics. And I think that often that is being done in the guise of, you know, being responsible to communities. I'm just curious what your thoughts on this would be.
I don't think businesses should take political stands. They should be good citizens in their communities in terms of trying to help solve social problems where they have competence to do so, and or where they can make philanthropic contributions that will help their communities they're part of. But taking political positions is, I believe, a mistake. I've not agreed with what I've seen happen in the last few years with more and more corporations taking certain advocacy position on political issues. Because first of all, that's going to be just the leadership's opinion that's running those companies. That may not be the opinion of the investors. That may not be the opinions of the employees that work there, or the customers, or anyone else. It's just the opinions of the leaders, and they're forcing those opinions on their larger stakeholder group, and they risk alienating their customers who don't agree with it. Customers may stop doing business with them because they're mad at them. They may find alternatives. They may just become disgusted and lose their respect for that organization. And the reality is, the country like the United States is very politically polarized right now. So taking sides is not in the best interest of your stakeholders. It's not in the best interest of your shareholders. It's not in the best interest of your customers. And Whole Foods tries to stay politically neutral. And I know from my own experience, having in the past, like, just written an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal about healthcare back in 2007, and Whole Foods was viciously attacked by people who didn't agree with my point of view. Even though it wasn't Whole Foods' point of view, I went out of my way to say, these are not Whole Foods' ideas, these are my ideas. They couldn't distinguish between me and Whole Foods, so they attacked Whole Foods for disagreeing with my views. And that was a huge learning lesson for me. So I have not taken political stands personally ever since in any kind of public way, because I didn't want the company to be harmed or hurt. And so I think the CEOs who are speaking up are actually damaging their businesses in the long run, and I think it's a mistake.
You've been a fierce, I would argue, critic of what's described as crony capitalism. But the model of capitalism that you're describing is sort of different from this kind of purist idea that we're just maximizing shareholder value. That's all that matters, and everything will be wonderful. That's kind of the traditional view. Your view is different, and what's developed is something really quite different. right?
Well, crony capitalism is when government sets certain rules and regulations and business tries to influence the rules and regulations to serve their own self-interest, and maybe at the expense of their competitors, or at the expense of customers, or the expense of some other stakeholder. And that's very much a perversion of what market should be about, and what any type of free market or free enterprise should be about. We shouldn't be basically sending bribes to politicians to twist the rules and regulations to favor us. I think that's it's unethical. It's wrong. Part of the problem there is that government wields a lot of power, and corporations frequently feel like they have to, if they don't engage in that way, they're going to be left behind. They're going to be at a disadvantage. So they're oftentimes, so you get this kind of unholy alliance between business and government, each doing favors for the other one. That's crony capitalism. If it gets too bad, it begins to move towards the more fascist directions, which it has done historically, where you've got the corporation aligned with certain power that, and it's like doing favors for certain governments, and the government's doing favors for the corporations, and it becomes more and more intertwined in perhaps unhealthy ways that may not be overall good for the economy or good for the society. I do worry about that in the United States. I see more of it happening.
I'm saying it must be tempting, like you just said, right? Because you see others kind of playing this game. And some people would argue that that's a big part of what D.C. is all about. I mean, not just for corporations, for other countries and regimes.
It's not really a problem in food retailing. So I guess I'm in a sector that's not really subject to much crony capitalism. But other segments, certainly, if you're in the medical industry in some form or fashion, crony capitalism is quite common there. It can be quite common in, obviously, in defense. And anything that's very dependent upon the government for business, or the regulations of government really affect it, you have the temptation of crony capitalism, and it tends to emerge.
So, you know, some people describe crony capitalism as a kind of, socialism, actually. And I think, you know, when we were talking offline earlier, you said, no, it's not quite like that.
It's not really socialism, because in socialism, the government actually owns the means of production. In crony capitalism, the means of production are still privately held, but they are somewhat controlled by the government. And it's slightly different, because it's like if the business plays ball, they get to make profits. So it's not like the profits are flowing to the government necessarily, but that's kind of the trade-off. That's how it's different, because socialism, at least, it's just a different type of unhealthy business arrangement. It's not the ideal of competitive free enterprise, which is innovative and creating new value, and competitors are free to compete. And in crony capitalism, in some ways, you're trying to lock your competitors out or make it more difficult for them to compete. As an example, it can cost up to $1 billion to bring a pharmaceutical drug to market. That means not that many get brought to market, and the ones that are very expensive, because you got to pay back that $1 billion investment. But it eliminates competitors. Not very many drug startups can afford to spend $1 billion to bring a drug to market. So that's a type of crony capitalism. That's not socialism, though, but it is a type of crony capitalism.
I was just looking at this recent poll, and we've seen variants of this again and again on Morning Consult, basically talking about how the younger generations of Americans are much more positive towards socialism and these kind of structures, let's say government control in general, and actually have quite a negative perception of capitalism.
Right. Worries me.
Well, you and me both, but do you have an idea of why it has become this way? What are your thoughts here?
I have a lot of thoughts about it. Intellectuals have never liked commerce. I mean, the whole history, Deidre McCloskey's tremendous economic history work demonstrates that throughout all history and all time, the intellectuals have disliked commerce. They don't like business people. They don't like their motives. They're envious of their wealth. And for most of the time in history, it's been kept under the thumb of the aristocrats and the intellectuals. With the wealth of nations and the birth of the Industrial Revolution and the Declaration of Independence in America, the genie got out of the bottle. And for about a 50-year period, the intellectuals favored business. They didn't have the word called capitalism. That came from Karl Marx later. But after about 50 years, they soured on it, and they've been trying to stick the genie back in the bottle ever since. If you think about it, almost all the peoples of the world that have been great, very good at commerce, have been persecuted. In the West, it's the Jews, the tremendous business people, and they've been run out. They've been run out of country after country historically. Why? Not because they have a different religion, but because they're so economically successful, it creates envy, and people want to confiscate that money and eliminate them as competitors. The same thing has happened to the Chinese in the East. The Chinese have a great business tradition, and wherever they go in the East, when they went to Thailand, or they go to Indonesia, they go to Singapore or Malaysia, the Chinese create great wealth, and then they're persecuted. So this has been a historical fact. And today, the intellectuals don't like business. I mean, the number, if you look at the number of academics in our universities, and you look at how many of them are progressive and anti-capitalist versus how many are more conservative and pro-capitalist, it can be 20 to 1. And that's now filtered down into our K-12 school system. So the message about capitalism, the message about business is fairly negative. And I think the young people that are coming up, that's all they've ever heard. And the other story is being suppressed. The goodness of free enterprise is being largely not taught any longer in our school. So I see it as an educational problem. And ultimately, the solution is to have more competitive schools and more choice in schools. We see the challenge now with critical race theory being taught in the schools, and there's just a different narrative, and there's a battle over that narrative. Capitalism is not loved by the intellectuals, and they have control of education, and that's kind of where it's not all intellectuals hate capitalism, but most of them do. When I meet professors, and if I start talking to them about business and capitalism, their disdain, they might say they love Whole Foods and they shop there all the time, but in general they don't like business, and they don't think wealth should be accumulated, that somehow they're unfair. So that all emerges, and I think that's what's being taught to young people, and that's why they favor socialism. Although there is, Jan, there's also an old saying, which is that, I don't remember who said it, maybe, I know I've heard Mark Twain might have said it, or Churchill might have said it, or who knows, but it goes something like this: if by the time you're 21, you're not a socialist, you don't have any heart, but if you're still a socialist by the time you're 30, you don't have any brains. And socialism's been tried 41 times in the last 100 years. 41 countries have tried socialism, and there are exactly 41 failures. It's not that socialism hasn't been tried. It's been tried over and over and over again, and it doesn't work. It doesn't create wealth. And economic freedom creates wealth. Economic freedom creates innovation, experimentation, competition, and it raises the standard of living, not for a few people, but for literally billions of people. If you go back, I don't think history is being well taught any longer. If you go back and you look at the historical reality of what the world was like 250 years ago, 94% of everyone alive on the planet Earth lived on less than $2 a day. And that's today, adjusted for inflation. 94%. 85% lived on less than a dollar a day. Illiteracy rates across the world were 88%, and the average lifespan was 30. It has been capitalism. It has been economic freedom. It has been innovation, creativity. It's been business people combined with scientific breakthroughs that have allowed humanity to begin to lift out of the dirt. And people just don't understand that. They look around and they see that we're not living in utopia. They look around and they see some poor people They look around and they see it doesn't seem fair that some have so much and others have so little, but they don't have any historical context for what it used to be like. And that's why I think every generation has a siren call of socialism. It'll create a better world, but it doesn't. It doesn't create a better world. It creates trickle-down poverty, and the society gets poorer and poorer. It's very interesting to me. We saw recent revolt or protest in Cuba, which is always held up as sort of a people are, they may be poor there, but they're super happy. Well, actually, they're not happy. They keep trying to get the heck out of Cuba and come over to the United States or get out and go to other countries. Yeah, the intellectuals don't like capitalism. They like socialism, but socialism doesn't work. And they just believe it hasn't been done right yet. This time we'll get it right. If we just get the right people in charge, this time it will work. Only it's not a question of motives or intentions. It's a question of whether it can create innovation and progress. And it really doesn't. Economic freedom does. Socialism doesn't.
You know, you mentioned briefly in some... the education around critical race theory as being something problematic. Why? Can you expand on that a little bit?
I hold to the vision that of the American founding that everyone is created equal, that we all have dignity, that we all have value, and we shouldn't discriminate against anybody on the basis of race or gender or sexual preference or anything. Everybody deserves dignity and respect. Everybody, regardless of their race. And teaching that some races are inherently exploitative or evil, that's a moving away from the vision of what Martin Luther King's great vision when he was helping lead the civil rights revolution in the 60s, when he said that, "I have a dream that someday my daughters will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." That's the vision I believe in.
You know, going back to socialism here, when I talk to people, young people who are interested in socialism and believe that it's a good system and so forth, they often will point to the Scandinavian countries, right, as an example of the great success of socialism. Your thoughts?
They're not socialistic. The Scandinavian countries, if you look at the Economic Freedom Index that both Heritage and the Fraser Institute in Canada put out, you'll see that the Scandinavian countries are very high in economic freedom. Let's take Sweden, for example, which is often held up as an epitome of the way what America should be doing. Sweden's corporate income taxes are 21%. Sweden has no minimum wage. Sweden has vouchers for education for every child in their country so that they can make choices of what schools they go to, and there's competition in schools. And Sweden has 0% inheritance taxes. So I often say, so you favor those things for the United States, if I'm talking to a more progressive person. And they say, well, no, I don't favor it. That's what Sweden does. If Sweden does it, why don't you favor it? I mean, obviously, the Nordic countries are more racially homogenous, and they're much smaller, lots fewer people, and they have better developed welfare states than, say, the United States does. But they're capitalistic. The means of production are owned privately. Corporate taxes are low. Competition is powerful. And they have to also compete in the world markets. So the Nordic countries, if you ask them, they'll tell you they're not socialistic. And when they were socialistic back in the 50s and 60s, their economies began to crash. But they woke up, put economic freedom back in, and they've created very high standards of living for themselves. So they're bad examples to use. The examples you should use for socialism are Venezuela and Cuba. In China, before it began to liberate itself economically, India back in the 60s and 70s, before it began to create more economic freedom, or the Soviet Union, or the Eastern European bloc. You can see the comparisons between Eastern Germany and West Germany. And I mean, West Germany was capitalistic and they flourished, and East Germany was socialistic and their standard of living did not advance, it declined. So we have these historical examples of socialism versus capitalism, and capitalism produces wealth, not for a few, but for larger amounts of people in the society, and socialism takes everybody down.
So what you have examples of in the Scandinavian countries are quite robust social safety nets on the other side, right? And that's interesting.
Favor social safety nets, but not for everybody, for those people who really, really need it. If you look at a place like Switzerland that has universal health care, but it's all private, it's all privately held. There's no government health care in Switzerland. It's all private insurance. There's a universal mandate, and then the government subsidizes potentially 100% if you're like homeless and super poor, to 0% if you earn a good income. But they give them lots of choices in what type of private insurance they will purchase. So is that the perfect system? No. Is it better than what we have in the U.S.? Undoubtedly it is. And there are other great examples. Singapore is another great example that has universal coverage, but through mandated savings programs and health savings accounts, and that's resulted in both a privatization of health at the same time a strong safety net. You can do both.
John, one of the things that I've been hearing a lot more chatter about from a variety of political persuasions is this idea of universal basic income, okay? Especially in the context of a lot of people having suffered greatly financially, especially under coronavirus and so forth. What are your thoughts here with this approach?
I think there needs to be a safety net that takes care of the poorest people in a society. Other than that, people have got to work. Work creates meaning. Work is creating value for other people. It's fundamentally corrosive, in my opinion, to the human soul to not work and create value for other people. And you're responsible for your own life. Universal basic income is bottom-up socialism is what it ends up being in the long run. I don't favor it. I'm against it.
I guess it's been almost a year and a half of, a really, really different world due to coronavirus, or perhaps the response to coronavirus. How do you see things having changed, I guess, fundamentally, or where are things going today?
Well, it's been very hard. COVID's been a terrible thing. It's a pandemic, worldwide pandemic, and it's caused the death of, beginning to be millions of people now. And it's ruined a lot of lives. That being said, you can't hide from a virus. The virus is, you can hide, but it's waiting for you when you come out. And humans have co-evolved with viruses for our entire evolutionary history. The influenza of 1918 through 1919, that was the worst pandemic of the last several hundred years, like probably since the bubonic plague. That's still with us. Humans just adapted to it. We still get the flu, but it doesn't kill as many people. And COVID is not going to go away. It's going to be with us the rest of our lives. It's another thing, another virus that humans are going to have to co-evolve with. And I could say I'm a great believer in vaccination, that the risk of COVID is far higher than the risk of the vaccination, even if there is some risk to the vaccination. And we're just going through a hard time, and we're going to get through it. But we're going to have to recognize that COVID, you just can't lock down your whole society and try to hide from a virus. It's absurd and crazy because the virus doesn't go away. It's waiting for you to come out. You lock yourself away for a year and a half. You finally come out. Guess what? The virus is still there. I mean, unless you're going to spend the rest of your life hiding, and then you don't really have a life at all. So this has been a terrible thing. I don't think we necessarily handled it. We didn't know what we were doing. We did the best we could, I suppose, but we made a lot of mistakes. And we have to just move on. We should get vaccinated. We should live prudently, do what we think is best. but we have to move on in life, and it's just, it's going to be with us.
And so how does that look like in your mind, in the positive way that you envision?
You know what I think? I think people should get vaccinated, and they should live an incredibly healthy lifestyle, because the secret is to keep your immune system as healthy and strong as possible. The reality about COVID, which the media doesn't report on, is that in the United States, like 80% of the people that have died from it were over the age of 65. Almost everyone that's died from it had an underlying health condition. That's way in the 90 percentile rates. America is 70% overweight and 42.5% obese. And many of the people that are dying are, they're not just not healthy. And so we need to take responsibility for our own health, and we need to get our immune system stronger. And we do that through healthy diet, through minimizing the toxins that we take in, to getting enough sleep, to managing stress better, to exercising. We have to take responsibility for our own health and our own vitality. And I watch people under COVID go one of two directions. Some people have just said, you know what, I'm going to get myself so healthy that if I get COVID, I'm going to be sure I survive it. And I've seen other people go exactly the opposite. I mean, the average American I read gained like 27 pounds in the last year and a half from COVID. And we were already really overweight. So I can understand that. We're locked away. We're depressed. We're lonely. And so we eat, and we don't get as much exercise. So, but still, the better strategy is to say, I'm responsible for my own health. I am going to survive COVID if I get it. I'm going to get my immune system absolutely as healthy and strong as I can. And then you just have to go on with life. There's risk in life. Death is going to meet us all someday, and there's no escaping it. And so we should just take responsibility and do the best that we can.
You know, definitely there's been, I was looking at various statistics under coronavirus, even like, for example, suicidal ideation, even among young people.
Suicide's way up, particularly for young people. It's terrible.
Exactly. And you know, people are looking at this political polarization that we were discussing a little bit earlier, and people believe there's a lot of reason to be unhappy.
We're responsible for our own consciousness. We are responsible for the choices that we make in our lives. We can choose to be grateful, see the beauty and wonder in life, or we can choose to see what all the problems are. They're both there. If we want to be happy, you're optimistic. You choose to be self-responsible. You choose not to be a victim. You choose to be grateful for the blessings that you have and not complain about the things that you don't have. And you choose love. You choose to connect with people and help others and serve others. That leads to a productive, happy, and joyful life. And utopia is not one of the options. We have to make choices. We have to act ethically, and we have to help each other and do the right thing by everyone we encounter. And that doesn't mean bad things don't happen. It doesn't mean we can't get caught by a pandemic. We might get hit by a car. I mean, accidents happen, bad things happen. You know, but life's an incredible thing. It's a great gift. We're not here very long. And the world is extraordinarily beautiful. People are amazing. There's so much to be grateful for. There's so much to be happy for. And there's so many people that need love and that we can help. And we should do the best we can to help others. And in doing so, we will find that life is a blessing and beautiful and wonderful.
Well, John Mackey, it's such a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you for having me on, John. I hope you have a wonderful day.